Hello, I'm Vershawn Young, host of New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers of African American life, culture, arts, and sciences discuss their new books. Today, I had the opportunity to speak with Daniel Sharfstein, author of The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White, published by the Penguin Press in 2011. In the early part of the 20th century, several novels constituting a genre called the passing narrative depicted African Americans who had skin light enough to pass for white. This social phenomenon, which was sociologically difficult to study because it risked exposure of racial identity at a time when being black could get you killed, was often depicted in literary form in such novels as Charles Chestnut's House Behind the Cedars, James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, and Walter White's Flight. Now in the 21st century, passing can be examined from an historical, genealogical, even legal perspective, as Daniel Sharfstein does in his brilliant new book. Please listen to our discussion of it. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Vershawn.
Today we're discussing a truly unique book on American history, law, and race, written by Daniel Sharfstein. It's called The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White, published by the Penguin Press this year, 2011. Sharfstein's book details the black racial histories of three families and both the legal and social circumstances that led to their becoming white. Sharfstein's book falls within the genre of neo-passing narratives, books that expand our understanding of what it means to cross the color line before and after Jim Crow and legal segregation. We're delighted to have Daniel Sharfstein, author of The Invisible Line, to talk with us today about his book. Daniel, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., and growing up, I had a father who told us stories about when he met Martin Luther King in college and marched on Washington, and I grew up in a house that had lots of great books, and by the time I was in high school, I had found Black Skin, White Masks on our shelves, and this was a book that I really connected with. And then in the 11th grade, we were assigned Invisible Man to read, and I was lucky enough to get the flu right at that moment. So I was home for a week and had lots of time to read the book, and it really just changed the way I see the world. So when I got to college, I knew I wanted to take some classes on African-American history and literature, and I wound up on my first day of school in a pre-1920 African-American literature class where the professor was talking about the spirituals and getting very, very excited, and all of a sudden he disappeared under the table. This was Professor Werner Solers at Harvard University, and all of us, we were seated around a small seminar table, and the students just, we all looked at each other wondering what was going on, and then he popped back up and started cranking a 78 record player, and Paul Robeson's voice filled the room. And I knew then that I was going to take that class, and maybe I knew then that this was something that would be more than just a class. In that class, I was first introduced to the works of Charles Chestnut and W.E.B. Du Bois, both of whom were really influential in my thinking, in the thinking that led to The Invisible Line. But actually, the immediate catalyst for this book was the summer after my junior year in college, summer of 1993, I went to South Africa to work on a nonpartisan voter education project in the townships outside of Bloemfontein. It was the summer before South Africa's first free elections. And I worked with a number of longtime anti-apartheid activists, and they said that they had all been classified as African, which was, I guess, the black designation by the government, except for one person we worked with who had been classified as colored, which was the mixed race designation. And she said that what she actually was not mixed at all, easily could have been classified as African. But in the 1950s, when the apartheid government was taking a census to fix people's racial designations, the census taker knew her father, who had been a police officer, and thought he'd honor his service, honor their friendship, by putting a C by their names instead of an A.
Hmm.
And the idea that, you know, we think of race in South Africa as something that was inevitable. You know, it was backed by the best mid-20th century pseudoscience. It was backed by the full power of a modern police state. And at the same time, it was really a revelation to me that it could be also the product of individual relationships, community dynamics, and really just one man's whim. And when I returned to the U.S. that fall, I immediately started looking for examples of how the same things could have happened here. And that's when I first started reading court cases where courts had to determine whether people were white or black.
Mm-hmm. And we should tell the listeners that right now you are a professor of law at Vanderbilt University.
That's right, in Nashville, Tennessee. And actually, one of the great things about being in Nashville is Charles Chestnut and W.E.B. Du Bois's papers are at Fisk University, so are John Mercer Langston's papers. And in Langston's papers, I found correspondence by one of the main figures in my book, actually John Mercer Langston's brother-in-law, a man named Orondatus Simon Bolivar Wall.
And you've already told us a little bit about how you have come to write the book. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the three families that you detail in the book, the Gibsons, the Walls, and the Spencers.
Sure. So this book follows three families who cross the color line and assimilate into white communities at different points in American history. And the first family, the Gibsons, they assimilated into a Welsh and Scots-Irish farming community in the South Carolina backcountry right before the Revolution. And for them, becoming white was really a function of their rising social mobility. Very soon after they moved into South Carolina from originally from Virginia, then through North Carolina, they became one of the wealthiest landowning families in their little region in the Peedy River Basin. And they, in a way, they reached a point where they weren't black, they weren't white, they were planters, and that's what really mattered. And their children married into the most powerful families around. And so they were accepted as white, and really it was a starting point for a rise that led them to the really to the heights of the Southern planter elite in the 19th century. And actually, one of the descendants wound up on the board of the University of Kentucky, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And I was struck by how influential some of the writers that you've already mentioned in your discussion are to the construction of the book. For instance, you take Charles Chestnut's passing novel, The House Behind the Cedars, as the title of your introduction, and you epigraph Ralph Ellison in the book. Can you tell us, for instance, why House Behind the Cedars is an important title for your introduction?
Sure. I, when I was interviewing one of the living descendants of one of the three families. I met with a man who was the great-grandson of Orondata Simon Bolivar Wall. And the Wall family was a family of ardent abolitionists and civil rights activists who became white in Washington, D.C. in the early 20th century, really right at the dawn of Jim Crow. And for them, their story was the closest to a classic passing narrative. The great-grandson was a man who lived in a house that was hidden from the road by a copse of trees. And when I asked him what kind of trees they were, among them they were cedars. And I immediately thought of Chestnut's novel. And Chestnut's novel is a remarkable novel in many ways. For me, it really resonated because it was perceptive about the role of law in the production of racial categories. One of the key characters in the early sequences of the novel was a judge who told one of the main characters, you know, here in North Carolina, you are legally black because of our North Carolina had a 1/8 rule. But if you move to South Carolina, which had a different designation of who's black and who's white, you can actually be white. So why don't you move there? Chestnut, his fiction and also his essays are really just such brilliant meditations on not just the ironies of race, but also the place of law in our understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, there's another aspect to that discussion between the judge and John, that main character in Chestnut's novel, that's also important, I think, to what you detail in your book, and that is, one, John was interested in also becoming a lawyer and wanted to apprentice with the judge, and being white and a lawyer would be more advantageous to him. But the other thing that seems to, I think, need a little bit more discussion about is just how even being a lawyer and now being legally classified as white in another state was not in and of itself a panacea for race relations, right? Mm-hmm. So when some of the families that you talk about in your book, for instance, let's say the Jennings family and becoming a planter and becoming accepted in the community as white, these families still face some racial prejudice, or they were susceptible to racial interactions at the time. Is that not correct?
Yeah. So the Gibson family, by 1800, they are really not just white, but they're on their way to becoming, you know, the epitome of white privilege. And at the same time, there was a memory of race that followed them, that seemed to echo. They moved from South Carolina to Mississippi and eventually Louisiana, and actually up to Lexington, Kentucky. And I found a memoir of a descendant, and he talked about asking his father why they had dark complexions. And he said he had heard stories that they descended from a gypsy maiden who had married a younger child of an English lord. And there are a number of these stories that the Gibsons told about themselves. They were descended from gypsies, or they were Portuguese Huguenots or Sephardic Jews, and always about explaining their dark complexions. At the same time, what is really interesting is becoming white was never truly an escape from race.
Mm-hmm.
With all three families, becoming white meant having to think very carefully about what it meant to be white in a slave society or a segregated society, how to interact with black people, how to talk about them. And I think for many of these families, most tragically, how to hate them. For the Gibsons, there was a descendant who was in the Kentucky legislature and voted against the 14th Amendment, ratifying the 14th Amendment. There was a member of the family, his brother helped devise the helped create Tulane University, and part of that his contribution to Paul Tulane's philanthropic bequest was a bequest originally written for the education of young persons in New Orleans. And this Gibson descendant inserted the word white between young and persons.
Mm-hmm.
So becoming white was not an escape from race. It's very easy for white people to tune out anything having to do with race and African Americans and think that it has nothing to do with them. What I found was there's no sure way of establishing yourself as white and living a white identity than hating black people.
Mm-hmm. Earlier when I mentioned the Jennings family, I probably misspoke. I was thinking about Jennings as part of the Wall family, and remembering an episode that occurred, I think, in a chapter, in the Spencer chapter, about Jordan Spencer and what the some of the townspeople had to say about him in relation to race. And I just want to read an excerpt quickly. And these are, you recount some statements that people had to say about what it meant to be white and racial mixing in relation to Jordan Spencer. And here it says, even people who cared about racial mixing understood the convenient notion that unless it was impossible to say otherwise, everyone in Johnson County was white. Quote, I always was in sympathy with the man, said a Paintsville businessman about Jordan Spencer, because he tried to be a good man and tried to avoid looking like a darkie, and because he wanted to raise himself up instead of lowering himself. Now, to me, when I read that passage, I started thinking about all the kinds of ways in which these not only Jordan Spencer, but other characters may have actively tried to disassociate themselves from black people. One of the things that's interesting about Spencer is, if I remember correctly, is that he's the one that colored his hair red.
Yeah.
And so these other people, especially the gentleman, the businessman here, is citing characteristics that were ideologically or traditionally associated with white people, trying to raise their class status and trying to avoid looking like a black person. And I'm just wondering if you could speak just a little bit more about that in relationship to some of the other families or characters.
Sure. So I should start by saying Jordan Spencer, his story is a remarkable story. He moved into the Spencer family moved into a what we would call an Appalachian mountain holler in eastern Kentucky in the late 1840s, early 1850s. And Jordan Spencer was visibly dark. And as you said, he dyed his hair red, but the hair dye technology of the 1840s and 1850s isn't what it is today. So every time he sweat, his sweat would run red. And he was a manual laborer and prided himself on working hard every day. So just about every minute of the day, he was sweating. So he was constantly reminding the people around him that he was different. But at the same time, they were still able to classify him as just a dark white man. And, you know, for the Gibsons, in terms of appearance, by the late 18th century, there was not too much of not too much controversy over their appearance. I mean, they still talked about their dark complexions, generations later. But it was thought that, in the words of one person, they had too much red and white in their skin to be thought of as black, that they were actually lighter than half the people in the South Carolina legislature. The walls, they were in the early 20th century, they too were very light-complected. And for them, it was less a question of changing their appearance and more about just keeping their mouths shut. For them, for many years, the generation that passed for white, the generation of OSB Wall's children, for many years they were very much a part of Washington, D.C.'s African-American community. They were proudly African-American. And they, in a way, being as light as they were, I was reminded reading about their experience of Adrian Piper's essay, Passing for White, Passing for Black,
mm-hmm.
That they must have spent, every day articulating that they were black to anyone who would reflexively categorize them as white in a segregated Washington, D.C. So you could imagine to police officers, to riders on streetcars, to shopkeepers. This was their life right up until they decided to move away and change their names and establish themselves as white.
Mm-hmm. One literary critic who wrote an introduction to Nella Larsen's passing, Mae Henderson, said that one of the interests that contemporary readers have in novels about racial passing or nonfiction books even about racial passing is that they educate us ethnographically about black life. Your book is part law, part history, and in some ways because it details, at least in the introduction and in the epilogue, reactions of some of the descendants of the families that you talk to, it could be also considered ethnographic in some ways. Could you talk to us about those parts?
Sure. So, in terms of the history, I view this story as a history of race in the United States from the 18th century well into the 20th century, essentially told through the stories of these three families who, in their own experience, they call into question the very notion of race itself. So it's a history of race. It's a history of ideas about race as they've changed over time. And all the while, even as race moved from being something about being really about slavery and freedom to assuming its more biological and hardline notions with segregation, even as that was happening, one thing I wanted to make a constant was that people were always crossing the color line and becoming white. That even some of the whitest people, some of the most quintessentially white people, most quintessentially privileged people in America, had African American ancestry. So, you know, as history, I wanted to tell a story of change over time, but I also wanted to tell a story about the illusions of race. I also wanted to talk about how, you know, we talked today about how race is a social construction, and one of the ways that law is particularly useful in this story is that you can see how law is a place where lots of people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, talked about race as if it were a social construction. I mean, people would literally use language like, we all know race is nothing but a legal fiction. And at the same time, those people could be the proponents of more hardline definitions of race. They could be the proponents of segregation. So, the law of race, it's a story of, it's a story about the vexed connection between liberty and equality. In a way, what was really interesting for me is that the moments where we see people talking about racial difference in recognizably modern ways, they're talking about it in terms of something that is born in the blood. These are moments of liberty for African Americans. Right around the Revolution into the early 19th century, as a lot of people are freeing African Americans in the South and as the North is emancipating African Americans, just before the Civil War, as abolition is reaching a fever pitch, and after the war, as African Americans are working their way towards citizenship and full citizenship in the U.S., I mean, these are moments of when in a way new ideas about inequality are forged. My discussion of the law is a discussion of a discussion of evolution and change. It's a discussion of how courts often knew that communities were letting African Americans assimilate in as white people, and at the same time, let them do it. Courts often backed away from really interfering with community processes, and it seems like the real effect of that was by helping white communities remain secure in their status by minimizing the fear that they could be that people could be reclassified. In a way, it enabled these white communities all over the South to really embrace the hardline ideologies of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to throw ethnography in there to insist that the book is ethnographic.
Right. Well, I did travel to just about every place I wrote about. It was very important to me to write this history through the eyes of the people who were participating in it. So I did think about the sociological, anthropological elements of the story. Absolutely. No need to apologize for that.
It certainly comes through to me, especially when you quote some of the contemporary descendants of the families that you write about. I'm thinking in particular about William Leback. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
Thomas Murphy, mm-hmm. both of whom can be considered enthusiasts of their personal genealogy. And in some ways, had interesting responses to the suggestion that they had Black ancestry. Could you talk about that?
Sure. I learned a lot from the living descendants who I spoke with. I mean, initially when I first traced families to the present, I wondered if I'd be breaking the news to anyone. Would I be kind of, driving the back roads of the South and knocking on people's doors and saying, guess what? What I found, which was really interesting, is that almost everybody, by the time I first contacted them, starting in 2004, 2005, and moving onward, they had already heard something in the 5 or 10 years previous to hearing from me. In a way, it was like the secrets of the generations were no match for Ancestry.com. All it took was one genealogy buff in any family, and every family seems to have one, and people would have these stories about going to the library, seeing a search of the 1850 census being available online, typing in their great-great-grandfather's name, and then having to call over the librarian to ask, what did the letters M-U-L mean if they're written by my great-great-grandfather's name? And, M-U-L, standing for mulatto, was a census designation from 1850 to 1920. So all these families had some amount of time to think about and process this information. They'd all had their revelatory moments. And the range of responses, it was really huge. So on one end, there was someone I spoke to who said, learning that my great-great-grandmother was a free woman of color in Louisiana, this is not somebody I wrote about in the book, really changed my outlook on life, changed the way I think about issues of race and civil rights, and I now, it's given new meaning to my life. I now give talks to African-American churches about the illusion of race. So that was one end of the spectrum. And on the other end was someone like Thomas Murphy, who, when I spoke with him, he said, learning that my great-grandfather was Orondatus Simon Bolivar Wall made me more racist than I had ever been before. I mean, in a way, he was, to convince himself that he was still white, it was like he felt compelled to hate blacks. But what was really interesting, even about that response, was Thomas Murphy told me this was his response, and at the same time, he couldn't stop researching his connection to the Wall family. Mm. In a way, he is, one of the most knowledgeable people about the Wall family genealogy, and he's posted that information, so he's really tried to share it with people. And so even as he was very conflicted with the story, he was still very committed to recovering it, and it clearly gave his life a connection to a big American story that was very important to him. So there were a lot of very interesting and intense conversations with a lot of people, and I really learned a lot from them.
Now, among the several descendants, living descendants that you talk about, William LeBach and Frieda Goebel and Thomas Murphy, among them, Murphy's comments are striking to me because even though he may be conflicted, he makes some very unequivocal statements. I'm going to say two of them. One is, and you say that after learning that he was a descendant of the Wall family, he marched into an Atlanta airport, rent a car where he was employed, and told his black co-workers, quote, "You can't call me a racist because I is one of you." And later, he says that he attributes Wall's success to his white father. And he says, the way I see it, I don't descend from a black man. I descend from a white man who couldn't keep his jeans in his pants. Now, the reason why that's striking is because it does seem in some ways to, even though he isn't interested in researching the genealogy, is actively also resisting black heritage.
Right. No, there are his words and his actions. And I think, sometimes they're at odds with each other. He was someone who, was very candid and very honest about, what his reactions have been. I think it really shows that, we're in this supposedly post-racial era. I guess when I first started speaking with Mr. Murphy, it was in the pre-post-racial era. So even in this post-racial era, I mean, this is a moment where you can really see how race and racial difference and whiteness still matters. There's so many ways that whites can talk about moving past race, and they can talk about colorblindness. They can talk about, just open up any number of recent Supreme Court opinions, and this is people talking about how race is over. But talking to Thomas Murphy, talking to all of these descendants, you really see how the literal relationship between blacks and whites, the idea that they have African American ancestry, really see the transformative power of that knowledge.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you if you would read an excerpt from the book to give us a sense not only of the content, but of the literary quality. But before that, I want to say to you just how delighted I am that you've written this book, and just how wonderful I find the writing to be. It's engaging, it's vivid, it's clear, it's really a masterpiece to me. It's exquisitely written. The structure with the alternating chapters going from the Wall family to the Gibsons to the Spencers and going back and giving us Civil War history, I think it's just it's wonderful. And I was interested in finding out just how a lawyer comes to write so well.
Right. Well, thank you. That your words are so kind. I started out as I was a lawyer, I was a journalist, and in college I wrote for the campus newspaper, and then after college I worked for a year as a stringer in West Africa, and then as a reporter in Southern California for a couple years, and I wrote stories about all kinds of people in all kinds of places. And I wrote lots of them. When I was a staff writer for the Pasadena Star News, I wrote pretty much a story every day. And it ranged from stories about gangland murders I once covered a basset hound picnic where all the basset hound fanciers of Arcadia, California, all gathered together at a park. I parked a block away, and the smell hit me as soon as I got out of my car. They would dress up their basset hounds, and the winner of the best costume competition was a basset hound dressed as Scarlett O'Hara. Writing about so many different kinds of stories, I think really helped me develop my writing. Then I think actually as a lawyer, a huge part of being a lawyer is taking a set of abstract ideas and relating them to a very particular set of circumstances. And so every time I worked on a case, it was always an exercise in storytelling. And I think a lot of wonderful writers, a lot of serious nonfiction writers today, trained as lawyers. And I think the ability to take individual stories and use them as a lens for viewing and thinking about larger issues, I mean, that's really a lawyer's skill.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you what's one of my favorite sections in the book, one I can't wait to talk about in the class that I'm going to be teaching your book in next semester. It's the excerpt when the slave catchers come to Oberlin, Ohio, the college town, and they are successful in kidnapping one black person. I can't remember his name exactly.
John Price.
Yes, and then at first, I mean, it's a fully dramatic scene, wonderfully rendered. You think that they're going to get away. They're 10 miles outside of the town, and Price lets out a yell to people who are passing by, and you think they either ignore him or don't hear him, and come to find out one of them goes back to town and tell them that the slave catcher gets Price, and they rise up and go to this place. And I mean, the drama on how it unfolds and how he gets let out, it's really dynamic and very interesting. And the book is filled with episodes like that. So can you read to us?
Sure. Let's see. I can read to you a section from that chapter, if you'd like. And it introduces Orondata Simon Bolivar Wall, who's one of the main figures in this book. And he eventually winds up in Washington, D.C. as a lawyer and really one of the fixtures of the rising black political class in Washington during Reconstruction. But before that, he was born a slave. His father had been his master, so in some ways it's a familiar story. But then his father, when Orondatus Wall was about 13 years old, his father freed him and his brothers and sisters and sent them to Ohio to be raised by radical Quaker abolitionists. And when I researched the question, it seems like he kept their mothers in bondage. And so eventually, Orondatus Wall wound up in Oberlin, Ohio, which was the most abolitionist town in America. And he worked as a shoemaker. All day long, Orondatus Simon Bolivar Wall worked with skin. The Oberlin shoemaker cut it with sharp blades, punched holes in it with awls, pinned it to lasts, and stitched it to soles. He shaped, molded, and manipulated it until it became something else. Every day, skin surrendered easily to his hands. It was tanned and dyed, polished black and every shade of brown. In a town where just about everyone was preoccupied with the fine line between slavery and freedom, Wall's expertise in matters of color and skin conferred upon him a certain authority. Asked once whether he knew the colors by which people of color were classified, the short, stocky man answered simply, "There were black, blacker, blackest." The day Anderson Jennings appeared, this is the Kentucky slave catcher who comes to Oberlin, the Kentuckian was the talk of Oberlin. The consensus opinion was that he was a slave catcher. But whom was he after? When would he strike? And what was the best way to resist? His presence was almost certainly topic number one in Wall's shop on East College Street in the center of town. It was cooler than the blacksmith shop, quieter than the sawmill, and less rank than the livery stable. In other words, it was a congenial place to discuss politics. And amid the workbenches littered with leather scrap, politics for Wall and his partner David Watson meant abolitionism. Watson, an Oberlin graduate, was an active member of the Ohio Anti-Slavery Society, and Wall had spent his life walking the line between liberty and bondage. Freed by their father and sent north, Wall and his brothers and sisters had been raised in comfort by their Quaker guardians in Harveysburg, Ohio, and treated as members of the town's finest family. But they lived with the knowledge that their mothers remained in bondage. As they came of age, Wall's older brother, Napoleon, used his inheritance to establish himself as a farmer on 1,300 acres nearby. A younger sister, Caroline, moved north to enroll at Oberlin. Warren Dottis, known as OSB or Dottis, decided to learn a trade. With his pick of professions, he settled on shoemaking, a curious choice. By the 1840s, shoemaking was not just a lowly line of work, it was a dying craft, rapidly becoming a mechanized industry centered in mill towns like Lynn and Haverhill, Massachusetts. As slaves, the Wall children likely wore cheap shoes mass-produced in New England factories. Yet the trade held a certain allure for Orondatus. It was neither loud nor exhausting nor dangerous and left plenty of time for thinking, reading, and talking. With surprising regularity through the 18th and 19th centuries, shoemakers turned to radical ideas. The last surviving member of the Boston Tea Party was a shoemaker. A disproportionate number of the mob kicking down the Bastille's doors had stitched their own boots. Philosophic cobblers formed the vanguard of English rioters in the 1830s and German revolutionaries in 1848. They wrote political poetry and proudly circulated books with titles such as Lives of Illustrious Shoemakers. For Orondatus, perhaps the most illustrious of them all was George Fox, revered in Harveysburg, who started life as a shoemaker's apprentice and went on to found Quakerism. After the Fugitive Slave Act passed, Wall helped start a local abolitionist society. Across the North, slavery's opponents were resolving to do whatever they could to keep runaways free. To their minds, the law of the land had been so corrupted that there was no reason to obey it. The Fugitive Slave Act was little more than a hideous deformity in the garb of law, the abolitionist orator John Mercer Langston told the Convention of Black Ohioans in 1851. His brother Charles, a schoolteacher in Columbus who would be the namesake of his grandson Langston Hughes, called on every slave from Maryland to Texas to arise and assert their liberties and cut their master's throats. I think I'll stop there.
Very beautiful. Thank you.
Can't be Charles Langston.
Right. I came to your book through the New York Times. There was a piece that you had written about one of the members of the families in the Times. Do you recall that piece?
That was Randall Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the great grandson of a free family of color. That had moved from the backcountry of South Carolina into Mississippi at the end of the 18th century.
And I raised that about reading that wonderful piece in the New York Times to ask, who are the readers that you imagine picking up your book?
Well, on my grandiose days, I think, the people who watch Ken Burns documentaries and watch Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
I view this as so much of a American story that, it is a story for people interested in African-American history and the history of race, but it is also a story for people who just want to wonder, people who wonder, why we are what we are here in America.
Mm-hmm. And the book reads as a, you know, everyday nonfiction book, but it also serves well as a book to be used in classrooms that have to deal with African American studies, law, history, et cetera, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. So, it, you know, it was very important to me. You know, it was of natural interest to a wide audience, but at the same time, you know, it's so important to document this. And I just wanted the research on everything down to the weather, you know, when various events took place, to be meticulously documented. And, you know, above all, it was a way for me to really, you know, see what narrative history can do in telling the story of race in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And readers will be able to find documentation to many of the things that you write in the book in the notes that are very detailed and point to various sources. I mean, it's just a wealth of information. So we've been talking for about almost an hour, and I've taken up a lot of your time. So I want to ask you right now to if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Sure. Well, I am working on a couple of things. So I'm working on an article project. You know, after a long book that it basically was, you know, 5 or 6 years of my primary research project, and then you know, my connection to the subject. I mean, I've been thinking about this for you know 18, 20 years. So I thought something a little shorter and more manageable would be a great follow-up. And what I'm writing about right now is a project about lawyers in Nashville, Tennessee, who argued against integration and civil rights in the decade after Brown versus Board of Education was decided. And Nashville was known as really a moderate town. And it was a place where people could be moderate segregationists without the real hardline political pressures to you know move to the extreme right. And there were these lawyers in Nashville who you know were very successful lawyers who essentially argued that you could. There's no need for white Southerners to take to the streets. They could follow Brown versus Board of Education to the letter, and still they predicted that life in Nashville and all over the South would change very little. And they crafted a series of arguments that over time really developed into these neutral right based arguments against civil rights and against integration that I think arguably has you know really moved into the mainstream and into the majority with today's Roberts Court. Hmm. So I'm trying to, you know, the Roberts Court in their Seattle and Louisville schools decision in 2007, which invalidated plans that were designed to promote integration. They quoted a lot from Thurgood Marshall and Constance Baker Motley and Robert Carter and, you know, the real architects of Brown versus Board of Education to say, you know, Brown only requires desegregation and not integration at all. I think the real progenitors of the court's position are these moderate segregationist attorneys that that Thurgood Marshall and Motley and Carter face constantly in court. And then I'm also beginning a new book project, and the book looks carefully at a man who Orondata Simon Bolivar Wall really idolized, and that was Oliver Otis Howard, who is the main Yankee who wound up the head. He was a Union Army general, became head of the Freedmen's Bureau, really a champion of African-American liberty and equality, and is the namesake for Howard University. And interestingly, after the Freedmen's Bureau collapsed and after Reconstruction really started to wane, he applied to rejoin the active duty military, and he wound up stationed in the Pacific Northwest. And one of his primary tasks was essentially to pacify the local Native American tribes. And I use that pacify as a euphemism. Mm. And the idea that this man who really articulated a new vision for what American citizenship could be and what the role of American government could be in terms of promoting the social welfare of individuals and really promoting freedom and equality. The idea that he could then become someone who forced Native Americans onto reservations and really in dramatic and tragic circumstances. The idea that he could then represent totally antithetical vision of American government, I think is really interesting. And I think he really represents and embodies this pivot in American political life from Reconstruction to America emerging as an imperial nation by the end of the 19th century.
Both of those sound really fascinating, the article and the book project. Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking time out to talk to us today on New Books in African American Studies.
Thank you, Vershawn. I really appreciate this.
We've been listening to Daniel Sharfstein discuss his brilliant new book, The Invisible Line, Three American Families, and The Secret Journey from Black to White, published by the Penguin Press in 2011. This book is gripping, it's exquisitely written, and as you can see from Daniel Sharfstein's discussion, it is a subject of passion today. Please pick up your copy.